Hello and welcome to the menu on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. This week we recap some of our favorite interviews and reports from the past 12 months. In the next 30 minutes we'll be in Montevideo to hear how the Uruguayan capital is enjoying a boom in great coffee.
For the last 3 years we can start saying that people know about specialty coffee and it has a lot to go, but yeah, it's 20 years behind the rest of the world.
We will also meet top chefs and restaurateurs. Marcus Waring is one of them.
You cut me in half, it'll say cook inside. It won't say husband, it won't say father, it will say chef. Because that's what I was right at the very beginning. And that's what I still am today.
And of course we'll hear a dinner soundtrack recommendation too. All that and much more ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. A nation of tea drinkers, much like the Brits or millions in India, Uruguayans traditionally start the day with mate, bitter-tasting tea leaves sipped from a gourd. The highly caffeinated drink is a ritual in itself, passed around among friends. But in the capital Montevideo, a new set of younger tastemakers have caught on to the global coffee trend. Our Latin America affairs correspondent Lucinda Elliott grabbed a table with the ones to watch.
Coffee, or primarily café con leche, was something occasionally enjoyed in Uruguay, with a serious amount of milk to wash down stodgy pastries. It was a drink reserved for specific outings, and hardly ever prepared in the home. But things are changing, with a group of younger, more well-travelled Uruguayans who are spotting a sizable gap in the market.
The main coffee that you will find, we don't have to give any names, but mostly like the good coffee, it's Italian coffee. And if you think about the way that that coffee arrives in Uruguay, it's mostly Brazilian coffee that was grown in Brazil, that went to Italy, was roasted in Italy, and then comes back to South America, to Uruguay. So it's like a very, very long trip for something that it's grown like 1,000 kilometers away from here. And that's the main coffee we roast. More than 50% of the coffee we sell here is coffee from Brazil. And it's sourced directly from the producers.
We see that every time that people choose to come and see what's inside, what's happening here, they stay for a long time. They really like this place and they tell their friends to come and visit and to try the different varieties of coffee we offer. We are not a specialty coffee shop per se. We just sell coffee here. We don't have any pastries, so people come exclusively to drink coffee. We offer 15 different varieties of espresso, and that's really shocking. And they come and maybe they try like 3-4 different espressos the same day, and they go out and tell their friends. And that's really exciting to notice how people talk about us outside the coffee shop.
That's Francisco and Martin, co-owners of Seis Montes. They roast beans in store from the Brazilian state of Minas Gerais, as well as other Latin American coffee growers. They're leading the change when it comes to what's on offer in the capital, Montevideo.
Well, we started, I think in August, it would be 3 years ago. And it started because Martin is the owner of a coffee shop, a specialty coffee shop in Carrasco, in another neighborhood around here, in Montevideo. And he used to buy coffee from another roastery. And we wanted to make specialty coffee a little bit more democratic. It was way too expensive here. Things in Uruguay, especially in Montevideo, are really expensive. We thought that the margin that we could make out of coffee was enough to have a very good product in a really reasonable price. And that's what the main reason is, like, have very good coffee at very good price. People really appreciate, because if you go to the supermarket, you will find Italian roasted commercial coffee even more expensive than what we offer, some coffees we offer here. We have very affordable Brazilian coffees and we have very expensive Colombian and Kenyan coffee. So it's about making people aware about what they are drinking and raise awareness about the whole flavor world you can get out of coffee.
Inside the roastery are sacks and sacks of different beans. Francisco takes me through.
Here we have coffees from Ethiopia, So you can see, tell the difference between
the bags. Is different,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
This is sort of a much thicker knit,
yeah,
and that's very sort of more, yeah, slightly more plasticated. Yeah,
yeah. There's plastic there and here now. It's just, and then you can tell also this the difference good. Of the sizes of the bags. This is a 70 kilograms bag, so it's from Colombia. Colombia and the countries from Central America produces bags from 69 to 70 kilograms.
Okay.
Africa is mostly 60 kilograms, okay, so it's a little bit smaller.
Yeah. How do you calculate how much you're going to roast?
So we weigh the coffees in batch of 4 to 5 kilograms, depending on the coffee. We cannot go any further than 5 kilograms per batch.
Okay.
And we can roast like 4 batches in an hour, so it's around 20 kilograms of green coffee. And that's green, so you lose a percentage with the roasting. It's around 50%. So at the end, let's say we have 15, 16, 17 kilograms per hour of roasted coffee. I'm going to open the bag so that you can smell the coffee.
Okay.
This is coffee from Colombia. It's a coffee that we sell a lot. And you want, you can put the hand in the bag just to smell it.
Oh gosh, it smells very different.
Yeah, most of the aromas that you get in the coffee, in the roasted coffee, are produced with the roasting process. The roasting process is a kind of a miracle.
For Monocle in Montevideo, and after plenty of cafecitos, I'm Lucinda Elliott.
Thanks to Lucinda Elliott for the report. You are with The Menu. One of the top chefs we interviewed in 2021 was Marcus Waring. I met him at the Michelin-starred restaurant Marcus at the Berkeley Hotel in London's Knightsbridge in July. There was a lot to discuss, including his thoughts about the state of the hospitality industry.
All lockdowns were difficult and all different. The first lockdown, everyone was really excited to get back out, and there was amazing energy in the hospitality for people to get back to work. And they did get back to work with big smiles and really eager to go. Second lockdown was for a month in November. That was quite stressful because then we came back. We then closed for a month. Then we reopened for 2 weeks, looking for that run up to Christmas, and then that was it. And then the long haul of a dark, cold, wet winter came in for 4 or 5 months. Coming out at the other end, people were completely changed. It was like looking at different people in the industry. The industry was all talking about the lack of energy, the lack of staff. People had left the country, people had not been able to financially continue, all sorts of different stories. But what we all said in the industry was that there is a shortage of people to work in our industry. But then you hear there's a shortage in every industry. You can't get someone to drive a van anymore. You can't get a lorry. You can't get the doctors and nurses. There's so many industries suffering, as well as my own. And it made me look at it and think in a different way, that now we need to be even more careful of how we look after our teams and our friends. We all need to look out for each other. There's a lot of mental stress, and a lot of people are suffering at the moment from, why are they not coming up to speed? Why are they not wanting to go back to work? People don't always want to come back to work after this third lockdown. People have changed the way they live.
How have you reacted to that massive change? How do you, for example, look after your staff at the moment, and how do you find new staff? I would imagine that you have lost some staff members as well. London, for example, has a lot of EU workforce, and many of those individuals have moved back to their home countries.
Mm-hmm. For me, you've got to stand tall. You've got to be at the front of the restaurant. You've got to put a smile on your face. You've got to put all your worries to one side and your own personal feeling about how you've dealt with the last lockdown, because I'm a human being like anyone else. If I show that I've got personal issues when I come to work, then people will feed off that negativity. I've got to come in and be positive. I've got to give them the vibe and the energy to move forward. I'll watch their back as long as they do their job. I'll be the rock that they can lean on if that's what they need. I'm here for them to talk to. They need me. But what I'm not going to do is fail. And what I won't do is close my restaurant because of a pandemic. I'll come back and I'll fight and I'll replace the people that have unfortunately had to leave. That's the only thing I can do. It's the only thing I know what to do. So I'm not going to let pandemic beat me. No, I don't want to do that.
Can you tell me how, if you think of your employees, how has a typical workday of theirs changed? What was it like before the pandemic compared to what it's like now?
I think when you look at a workforce, they have worked all their lives up to a point where it became stop. You know, people in catering, hospitality never stop. You know what it's like. You know, you go on holiday for 2 weeks, you come back to work, you've had a great holiday, back in normal times. It takes you a day or two to adjust coming back to work. You're always thinking about your holiday, you're in the airport, you start to get a bit depressed because you've got to go back to work. We all know what it's like the night before. Imagine how that feels after 14 months. But also, when you've gained momentum, we know that when you go on vacation, your body clock takes 3 or 4 days to slow down. You don't really start to feel good on a vacation until you're in your second week. And before you know it, you're thinking about coming home. And that means that you're constantly at this pace, this work lifestyle pace, and you're moving, you're moving. People have come back to work and their body clock has completely stopped. And all that energy of years and years of building up to that point of closure has just completely gone down to ground zero. And so I think a lot of people feel that they're starting from scratch again. They don't have the energy they had before. They don't want to work the hours they worked before. They don't want to look at the same employer as they've been looking at for the last X amount of years. And so this mental change has made them move, go home, go back to their parents. It's cheaper. Complete lifestyle change. Leave the industry. All different cases, all different scenarios that are popping up in front of you. It's like a colander. You know, you're bunging up the holes as much as you possibly can, and then another one will spring up. And it's going to be like this for a while.
In England, most restrictions have now been lifted. How optimistic do you feel about the rest of 2021 when it comes to, first of all, what you do, and secondly, more widely, the hospitality industry?
I think we've got to just dig deep, get on with it. The government make the decisions from the science and the doctors. That's their advisory. You know, that's where they get the information from. I think now we just have to just try and do our best. The Prime Minister has asked the country to be wise, to think on its feet and think of other people. It's now down to us to make this work. It's down to us, the population, the people of this country, to be responsible for our own actions, wear masks where need be, look after people, wash your hands, do the right things, and just be thoughtful of other people. And I want the industry to carry on. You know, I don't want it to close again. You know, listening to at the moment about all the poor people in theatres and shows, and there are other people having a bad time as well as my industry. But I think that the government are doing what they're doing. They've made their choice now. We now have to just get on with it.
And looking at, for example, those staffing issues, do you think the industry will need to change something?
I think the industry just needs to become even better at what it already does. We talk about better lifestyle, work-life balance. We talk about better wages, talk about all sorts of different things. That's already there. It was already there. You know, people can come into our industry and have an 8-hour job or a 6-hour job or an 18-hour job per day. You can work a week, you can work, do whatever you like. You know, catering offers something for everybody. It's just a matter of choice. We live in a Western world. We do not live in a place where we're governed and told how to live. We can live the way we like. And I think that's called freedom. And I think that's one of the most important things and one of the nicest things we have. And Boris Johnson's just given us that freedom back. If we go back into a lockdown, it's us. We have messed it up. We're the people. We're the people that have messed it up, not someone else.
That was Marcus Waring speaking to me in July. Another favourite guest of ours in 2021 was the Swiss chef Daniel Hamm, who is one of the biggest names in contemporary fine dining. He is maybe best known for the 3-Michelin-starred 11 Madison Park, his famed New York restaurant which made the controversial move to a plant-based menu earlier this year. Away from the Big Apple, he also opened another restaurant in 2019, Davies and Brook in London's Claridge's, which managed just a few months of service before its pandemic-enforced closure. With both sites back open, Monaco's Charlie Filmacourt caught up with Hamm to discuss the challenges and the future of the restaurant industry.
It was scary at first because most people didn't believe that there was going to be an audience who will pay that kind of money for a plant-based meal. But for me as a chef, during the pandemic, it became more clear how broken our food system is. I also thought a lot about what luxury means and what is the new luxury. And I realized that a lot of the things, and I feel guilty myself, but a lot of the things that we are still holding on to and celebrating are not luxurious at all. Like some of these ingredients, like caviar, for example. Caviar is farm-raised. It comes from far. it's plentiful. You can buy it almost anywhere. You can actually find caviar at the airport. And it doesn't even taste good compared to what it once was. So it's an old idea that we're holding on to. And I think the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic, I just committed to myself that I'm not going to continue the way we have. And the future, in fact, is plant-based. It is crystal clear. It is not sustainable in the way we farm and the way we consume meat. It was also like, I realized that this is the direction the world is going and this is the direction we have to go. So this isn't an anti-meat movement, but this is pro-planet. And as a creative working with food, I feel like the creativity should go towards creating magical dishes with vegetables. The world definitely does not need another preparation of a butter poached lobster or a crispy skinned duck or a foie gras. We just don't need that in a creative way. And, you know, I've been celebrated as a chef, pushing the boundaries and change to stay the same. And so if that's really true, I almost felt the responsibility to open up that dialogue. Mm. We wanted to make sure that by doing so, we wouldn't lose any of the magic or any of the deliciousness of what a meal was before. And we definitely studied what makes a duck so delicious, or a lobster, or a crispy pork belly, for example. And we thought about that, and we, for example, at 11 Madison Park, we added one course is a fried course. We have this fried pepper because it's like biting into something fried is incredibly satisfying and delicious. But it also, you know, the fried course doesn't make it sound like that. But overall, the meal, my experience has been that the meal is a lot healthier than it was before. And also the guest experience, there's almost this euphoria at the table where I don't even know where it's coming from. But before it was like, by the time people got a main course, they were so stuffed and overly filled and kind of ready to go home. And now the energy level is very different. As the meal progresses, people, it seems like, are having more and more energy. And, you know, they go home and they sleep much better. And the next day, if I see them or they call me or write a message, everyone is so thankful they had a healthier meal.
I mean, that's really interesting to hear. I've never thought about it in that context before. Moving on to London, obviously over the last year, it's been quite difficult to travel between London and the US. How has it been for you? Has it been difficult not seeing the Davies and Brook team, you know, managing, I guess, from afar?
Absolutely. Of course, we always want to be together in the same room and in the same kitchen. I did manage to come during the pandemic a few times, and it was actually not as difficult as you would think. But, you know, we're also just challenged here with figuring out. We also had a lot of people leave. Like, people went back to Italy, to France, too. So there was also a shortage of staff, which is a big topic right now, yeah. And it's real. Even for some of the greatest restaurants in the world, they're actually having a hard time to find staff. I think that's one of the bigger challenges we're facing right now.
And obviously, before the pandemic, you hadn't had too long as a restaurant. It was only a couple of months of service, wasn't it, before the closure? And I mean, I was going to ask, you know, how long does it take a kitchen to get back into its rhythm? But if so many of the staff have had to actually leave the country, where do you begin again? How do you pick up?
I'm really proud of the team that's there, and most of them moved here from New York. Some of them are European, but they worked with us in New York, and in particular, the GM, Annika Brooks, and the chef, Dimitri Maggi, and the sommelier, the wine director, Gabriel. And it's just an incredible, the core team is super, super strong, and they went through a lot, but they stayed positive and optimistic and have managed to uphold the incredible quality that we stand for.
That was Daniel Hum in conversation with Monocle's Charlie Phil McCourt. Our final stop today is Mexico City, the district of Xochimilco to be precise. While it's often referred to as the Mexican Venice due to popularity with visitors, the area is a lot more than a tourist destination. It also serves as a breadbasket to the capital. Since before the Aztec age, locals have grown fruit and vegetables on small islands rooted to shallow canal beds known as chinampas. Today, that way of life is under threat from pollution, urbanization, and economic pressure. Countless chinampas have been abandoned or sold as families move away to seek a more sustainable line of work. But the new Arcatierra project hopes to save traditional farming with help from leading chefs. Monocle's Frederick Bernas reports.
Verdant views, winding canals, and a dozen workers tending the land. This afternoon in Xochimilco feels like an idyllic country scene. But we're actually just half an hour's drive from the urban chaos of Mexico City. In pre-Hispanic times, the capital was built around canals and lakes. But today, the Xochimilco district is all that remains, and its rich agricultural heritage is slowly fading away. That's where Arcatierra comes in. It's a social enterprise which aims to forge a sustainable future for family-run chinampas, an Aztec word for floating gardens where fruit and vegetables can be grown. Here's one of the founders, Lucio Usubiaga.
The
heart of the project is that farmers are the most important people in society. They don't only grow vegetables to eat, but they generate health and clean the air and water. For us, they are the guardians of the earth, and they also maintain important cultural traditions.
Lucio and his partners have a decade of experience in the field with another project, Yolcan, which built a strong network of local providers, as well as starting its own farm, the Chinampa del Sol. The central area is designed in the form of a mandala, with a water hole in the middle and beds of vegetables arranged in sunbeams radiating outwards. As well as growing crops that are sold to many of the best restaurants in Mexico City, the Chinampa del Sol is a testing ground for regenerative techniques, which are shared with partner producers. Lucio told me about one of them.
Pues lo que primero que llama la atención es que pues en medio de un cultivo de hortalizas tengamos diferentes variedades de árboles.
The first thing you notice is that in the middle of a vegetable crop, we have different kinds of trees. Farmers usually say trees take up a lot of space and give too much shade. But what we're seeing is that they can actually produce higher fertility when we prune them. They retain water and recycle nutrients because their roots go very deep. So when you cut the branches, those nutrients return to the earth and feed the plants.
Pues estamos regresándole esos nutrientes a las plantas.
New ideas are combined with traditional knowledge, such as the chapín method, which goes back for generations. Seedlings are planted in little cubes of mineral-rich mud, which has been pulled up from the canals and left to dry. The plant gets enough nourishment to live for several weeks as it germinates and starts to develop, before being moved to the main cultivation zone. Blending history with modernity is a core concept of Arcatierra, but when Lucio started working in Xochimilco, some were skeptical. Local activist Manuel Rodriguez explains.
Al principio lo veíamos como un extraño, como un extranjero, como alguien que no era nativo de acá de Xochimilco.
At first, we viewed him as an outsider. Is this guy coming here to take away what belongs to us? But then we saw he didn't really mean any harm. He wanted to teach people. If you turn up and say, I don't know anything about agronomy, sustainability, or farming without chemicals, they'll show you how easy it is. And then you can sell for higher prices because the focus is on quality, not quantity.
Porque la evolución de ellos es meter calidad, no cantidad.
Arcatierra currently rents half a dozen chinampas and collaborates with five Xochimilco families. The venture has also expanded further afield and now works with more than two dozen farms outside Mexico City. As well as being sent to restaurants, their produce is packed up in baskets, which are distributed to individual customers around the capital. Lucio believes that direct connection between consumers and the source really sets Arquetierra apart from other providers.
Muchas empresas grandes dicen que trabajan con productores locales.
A lot of big companies say they work with local producers. It's super fashionable to take photos of men in fields, but it's all lies. These images have no relation to real life. Organic agriculture has been co-opted by a market mentality, which actually makes a negative impact on the environment. Studies show that some organic producers have a heavier ecological footprint than non-organic ones. In Mexico, very few companies help the community, but their products fetch a higher price and get that organic certification. We think it's a scam.
Pero pues ya tiene su sello orgánico, ¿no? Y nosotros creemos que es una estafa.
Arquetierra has strong relationships with Mexico City's thriving gastronomy scene. They take orders from about 40 restaurants, whose owners are frequently invited to see the chinampas for themselves. One recent visitor was Klaus Meyer, a globe-trotting chef with roots in Germany, Mexico, and the United States.
I've always been that kind of chef that, like, I had to go to the market. I had to go to the farmer to pick out the vegetables.
Klaus spent several years at Quintonil, a renowned Mexico City eatery which focuses on local flavors. He believes many of his colleagues go for the easy option, the vast Central de Abasto market, where price is often prioritized over quality.
People are really commonly drawn to having vegetables coming from the Central de Abastos. I wish there was more people like Lucio, you know, because without him, like, we won't have like this high-end vegetable. What you pay in Arquetierra comparatively to like what you would pay in Central de Abastos is very different. And the more restaurants that provide organic vegetables, the more conscious everybody becomes of like what they're eating, and then being like, okay, well, you know what, I'll pay an extra 5 pesos or 10 pesos or whatever the hell it is, and, you know, help these people, you know, improve their life.
Klaus plans to use Arquetierra as a key provider for his new restaurant, Anonimo, set to open later this year. Crop rotation schemes designed to keep the soil healthy mean the vegetables on offer change every few months, and so will Klaus's menu. It stems from the need to avoid monocultures, which can damage the land because the same thing is planted year after year. Finding the right balance is a fundamental element of Lucio's sustainable approach.
Hay maneras de producir mucho.
There are ways to produce a lot, which will still save water, keep carbon low, and create biodiversity. With the chinampas and families in our project, it's incredible. You're constantly improving the product, with fewer pests and better soil. That's regenerative agriculture, and it really works. But the model also means that consumers need to respect seasons, the size of vegetables, and production logistics. We have all these ideas, but they'll never take off unless people start buying.
At the end of the day, that holistic vision will only be achieved if society can radically adapt its habits. Arquetierra is building a comprehensive strategy to promote greener values, including tourist experiences, research projects with universities, artist and chef residencies, and an Escuela Campesina school. Walking around the Chinampa del Sol, one thing is clearer than ever. It all begins back at the roots, literally and metaphorically. For Monocle, in Xochimilco, Mexico City, I'm Frederick Bernes.
And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday if you're listening in San Francisco. Meanwhile, do check out our Menu spin-off show Food Neighbourhoods for great recipes. This show was co-produced by Charlie Filmacourt and Sophie Monaghan Coombs and edited and mixed by David Stevens. I am Marcus Hippie. Once again, we finish this programme with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here is Ten Snake with Automatic. Thanks for listening. Look what you're doing to me.